Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Water. We all use it. We all need it. Today we're airing a special report about the struggles many people in the coal fields of southern West Virginia face day in and day out.
We usually have to do bottled water because we don't drink it at all. Even on good days, we don't ever drink the water here.
I have a water treatment system personally that's salt-based, and they say over the long term that's not good. But we're thankful for what we have.
Water to get up to get ready for work in the morning. To drink water, you have to go out and buy water out of your pocket now because the water system is not flowing like it should. I try not to complain, and then I just ask the Lord to bless us and keep us.
Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. January 9th marked 1 year since the Elk River chemical spill that left hundreds of thousands of West Virginians without safe water in their homes. It brought a new level of awareness to some folks of just how easy it is to take water for granted. Last year, American Water, the company that supplied the water to these West Virginians, said it's getting harder and harder to get water into homes across the country because of scarcity and aging infrastructure. While southern West Virginia has an abundance of water, the crumbling infrastructure and extreme terrain creates challenging situations. So although the nightmare for those folks in West Virginia's capital city might be over, going without water is a way of life for some people in the coal fields. This episode, we're dedicating an entire show looking at this issue. Many of the current water systems in place were installed in the early 1900s by coal companies, while other places simply don't have water in their homes at all. For some communities, a boil water advisory is a way of life, like in Keystone in McDowell County, where residents have been on an advisory since 2010. Neighboring North Fork is often called the Sister City and has been on a boil water advisory since 2013. The water systems are currently operated by the cities, but the McDowell County Public Service District is in the process of taking on the responsibilities. Just this past year, a project with several phases began that's expected to bring relief to the region. It's a basic human need. There's food, clothing, shelter, and water. How long could you go without clean water in your home? Governor Tomlin issued a state of emergency in 9 West Virginia counties for almost 7 weeks. The declaration dispatched the National Guard to assist and deliver clean water for the affected residents. But for the town of North Fork, a boil water advisory since July of 2013 didn't get any attention and has not merited a state of emergency.
We usually have to do bottled water because we don't drink it at all. Even on good days, we don't ever drink the water here.
Nicole Bright lives in North Fork with her husband and 2 children. Including the active advisory, the town of about 180 customers has been on 7 boil water advisories since 2009, some lasting for months. It's been an ongoing issue for years.
That's not how it's supposed to be. This is like third world country or something.
Bright welcomes me into her home and explains that the white plastic buckets stacked at the door are for holding water. The family has to be prepared for the next time they go without water.
Madison, she's small, so she bathed a lot in the sea. But here's some more water jugs. But as far as us, we had to go to like my grandma's, or, and here it is. And also,
Bright taps on another stack of plastic containers piled in the hallway just outside the bathroom. This stack is to flush the toilets. You see, here, the biggest challenge is having water at all.
The water, it goes off pretty often and stays off for about, last time was 27 days. And it's real hard to do with the kids going to school and cleaning and washing clothes and cooking and dishes. It's just really hard. But usually, before it goes off or anything, it'll be real dirty looking and then it'll be orange.
For Bright and other residents in North Fork, losing water is so common that her family now has a routine when she does laundry, brushes her teeth, and other everyday tasks. To do the dishes, she first goes to the front porch, and then
get the water, then you come in, you take 5 gallon buckets and pour it into a little bitty pot, and then we heat it up, which usually takes about, 45 minutes or something to do, to fill them up and get enough water in there to wash and rinse.
Added expenses include bottled water, paper plates, and travel. Still, she tries not to complain.
3 or 4 days, yes. When it's out for a while, we do call, especially when you're able to get off the hill and not see anyone working on it. Now, my neighbor, she'll call them every 5 minutes. That's why I try not to give them such a hard time, because Lord knows I know she does. So I try to be nice, and then I'll call the neighbors.
The water system operated by the town of North Fork is outdated, and the filter needs to be replaced. So employees have to flush the system about every other day, causing the pressure to drop, especially for customers like Bright, who live at higher elevations.
It seems like sometimes when you live in a place like this, you're not heard, as well as you would be if you were somewhere else in a different town or something like that. Here it's like, okay, you're in North Fork, so what, you're in McDowell County. What do you expect? That kind of attitude.
But some folks in McDowell can remember a different attitude for the region. A little further up Route 52, we find Betty Younger. A coal miner's daughter, Betty Younger grew up in McDowell County and remembers a very different community during the 1950s. Younger sits on her front porch, which sits close to Route 52, a road busy with coal trucks. She reminisces about her days in the Kyle coal camp.
It was just a fun time for school and all. We all rode the school buses together, and it was just a big community of happiness. Everybody, every neighbor looked out for each other, and it was such a difference then than it is now.
Like so many coal-dependent communities, McDowell has suffered the boom and bust of the industry and a sharp population decline. In the 1950s, there were more than 100,000 people. Today, less than 20,000 remain in the county.
This part of McDowell County is looked upon like, there's nothing here. No one wants to come back here to stay. They come back to visit, but no one wants to come here and back to really to live in certain sections of McDowell County. We just don't have like we should, like we once had.
Younger has lived in this home in Elkhorn for about 6 years. There have been so many issues with the water, she just assumes not to drink it and says she rarely uses it for cooking. But the quality of the water is the least of her worries.
We never know when we're not going to have water.
And that's the story for several communities in the region. While winter months can be particularly hard because of freezing pipes, water outages could happen in places like Elkhorn, Keystone, or North Fork any time of the year.
You need water to get up to get ready for work in the morning. To drink water, you have to go out and buy water out of your pocket now, because the water system is not flowing like it should.
This past summer, a project that residents have been hearing about for years finally broke ground. Phase one of what's being called the Elkhorn Water Project. When all three phases are complete, the project will replace the system that Younger and other residents currently rely on. Phase one will replace a leaky, rusty tank that is believed to date back to the 1940s, set up by coal companies of that day. Younger's house sits just beyond the phase one project. But like so many folks in the region, she's thankful for what she does have. To Younger and other folks, it's a way of life.
I try not to complain, and I just ask the Lord to bless us and keep us, that we have water when we need water. So
our ambition and our goal is to provide as much clean water as we can for every citizen of McDowell County.
That's Eldon Green, Assistant Director of McDowell County Public Service District, after the groundbreaking ceremony last year.
We are very grateful for how that through the slow-moving bureaucratic process of the government, we're finally seeing this good thing happen in our county today.
Green is proud to say the district started out with 500 customers in 1990 and has more than 3,000 customers today.
There's a crumbling, decaying, almost non-existent water system in the area, and not even all of our customers or households have that public water. Some have springs and wells. But as with any rural community where the major industry has come and gone, we face negative things. We face low incomes. We face dilapidated housing. And it's just been a terrible, terrible struggle.
Phase 1 will bring water to Elkhorn, Mayberry, and Switchback. The McDowell County PSD is working to find funding for several other projects like this one throughout the county. The Big Sandy Rotifield extension will bring clean water to Green's own home. He currently has a deep well.
I have a water treatment system personally that is salt-based, and they say over the long term that's not good. But we're thankful for what we have.
The first phase of the project was funded by grants and loans from the United States Department of Agriculture, Rural Development. The dated systems in this part of southern West Virginia took an even bigger blow in 2001 and 2002, when what was called the 100-year flood hit 2 years in a row. The massive floods impacted everything, including water systems, and had a devastating impact on the communities.
They worked so hard to put back what you took away before, just to have you come and take it all again. 10,000 people cried, 7 people died, and I could hear the devil laughing in the wind.
Muddy water, can you hear me? Can't you see what you have done? Can't you see that you're not welcome here today? We worked hard all our lifetimes for what little bit we had, just to have you come and take it all away.
Those floods only magnified the water challenges in that region, but the problem stretches further than McDowell. Looking at a map that says Region 1 Planning and Development Council Water and Sewer, GIS specialist Eric Combs paints a picture of the need for potable water in McDowell, Wyoming, Monroe, Summers, and Mercer counties.
There is a great need throughout the whole state, but it seems like there's a greater need, per se, in southern West Virginia.
Combs points to 58 water and sewer projects expected in the near to distant future for this area. One reoccurring challenge is replacing dated systems left behind by coal companies.
Community of Gary in McDowell County, that was put in by American Mine and Steel, so U.S. Steel rather. You're looking at 50s, 60s, and it hasn't been updated since.
That's one dated system that Jennifer Haas is familiar with. Haas, now the project manager for the West Virginia Water Research Institute, grew up in Gary and says during the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, her father maintained the Gary water system as an employee of U.S. Steel. Around that time, the company began to pull out and close mines in the area.
When they left, they turned it over to the city, and my dad ended up taking over operation, being the operator for them, for their water system and also the wastewater system. They eventually brought other folks on board for the wastewater side, so he stayed with the drinking water side until just a few years ago.
And that's a common story throughout the coal fields of West Virginia, but some communities didn't necessarily keep water operators. In neighboring Wyoming, County Clerk Mike Goode explains.
Back in the 30s and 40s when coal was booming, coal companies made these coal camps, and they put in water systems for them. As the coal companies moved out, they abandoned those utilities, and the citizens had to take them over. Those things, like everything else, they were worn out. And it just came to the fact that somebody had to do something.
Goode and other elected officials made it a priority to replace the coal camp water systems and is proud to share success stories about places like Copperston, Wyoming, and Glover, where it was the folks in the communities making the repairs and doing what had to be done to get water in their homes.
Glover, those people get out in the middle of the night, older people, you know, 70 and 80 years old, they're out digging up water lines trying to fix a leak. It ain't supposed to be that way in America.
Despite the struggle to maintain these dated, crumbling systems, throughout the region, it seems the communities left with coal company plumbing were the fortunate ones. Some places don't have systems at all, but they make do with what they have. Jennifer Halls paints the picture she saw at Coal Mountain.
Their source of water was a reused gasoline tank that set up on the hillside that collected water from spring, and then a series of garden hoses brought it down the hill basically to another storage tank that someone would go and add a few gallons of bleach to ever so often to disinfect it. But that was the water that was then distributed to the homes for people to use.
For those who might just be tuning in, we're not describing some undeveloped, impoverished country, but a community in the United States of America, not too far from the nation's capital. Haas says the Coal Mountain water system is pretty typical for the coalfield region. Not necessarily a gas tank, but...
You know, there's communities all over the country. Unfortunately, Appalachia is very heavily populated with these small communities that they may have a spring with a water hose coming down to the homes, or they go and collect in water jugs, or they'll go to the river and collect in water jugs. They use that water for toilet flushing, for rinsing or washing clothes, but as far as for cooking and drinking, they probably buy bottled water.
And residents are resourceful, resilient with these circumstances. For some folks, it's the abandoned coal mines that are often used for a source of drinking water, too. Like this one in Itmann in Wyoming County, where a pipe comes out of the side of the mountain on the side of the road. Folks often stop to fill up. County Circuit Clerk David Bug Stover grew up just a few miles from here in Pierpoint.
And they ran it from an old coal mine on one side of the mountain, under the railroad track, and across the creek, and then dug ditches and ran it to the house in Pierpoint. The system there, in fact, is much the same now. It's from a different coal mine, and the town actually owns the site of where the exit of that mine, and a little tiny site where they build a big tank. And all that water, gravity feeds down to where the houses are. And it, sometimes it's treated and sometimes not. But it's water that comes there from a coal mine. That's how they get water where I'm from.
Stover says it was truly a community system with its own set of challenges.
You go out and try to fix it. If you can't find the leak, sometimes my mom, one time I remember, didn't have water for 3 months. It can almost drive you to the edge of being insane for months. So as much as I felt, and I did feel, for the people in Charleston who were without water for a week, whatever, I know what it's like to go for months. And if you want water, you go somewhere and carry it out of the creek or out of a coal mine. That happens. It happens today. And it will continue to happen for a while.
So while pickup trucks hauling water was an unusual and perhaps unsettling sight in Charleston last year during the chemical spill, it's common and part of everyday life for folks in the coal fields.
They make haul around a great big tank in the back of a truck. What those people tend to do is drive to a place where water's coming out of the mountain, out of an old coal mine, and they'll simply back their truck up and either directly under the flow or run a pipe from it and fill that up. And then they'll have, you know, 300 or 400 gallons of water in the back of their truck. And they'll come up to their house and hook it in and run water till it's gone and go do the same thing. Still going on today.
I should also point out that while doing this report, I found folks proud of their independence and accepting of what they called the sacrifice of mountain living. After all, it's more expensive to install a system to reach residents on a mountain than it would be for a flat city. Others were impatient with what they called empty promises of access to public water. Still, for the self-proclaimed mountain men, they wouldn't have it any other way. Again, Wyoming County Clerk Mike Good.
But you have people that are third or fourth generation that they've had to carry their water or use a well that's got a lot of iron in it or have a spring. And they don't know that there's a better life than that. And, I mean, it's healthy. It's better. It's healthier for you to have good city water. You know, it's treated and, you know, chlorine, it's sanitized and all that. I mean, it's got to be healthier.
But mountain springs and abandoned mines can be a good source of water. Some of the best water in the world, in fact. Sometimes. Mark Glass with Downstream Strategy says folks still should just be cautious.
What you worry about there, I think, too, is the same thing you worry about if you're doing a surface water. You know, your groundwater needs to be protected in the same way. So what are the potential contamination conduits to that? You know, and if you're in areas of mining, certainly there's lots of shafts and, you know, we hear all the talk about, you know, abandoned gas wells being potential conduits if there's surface spills and things like that. So they would still need to be under these same source water protection assessments. And then assessing all those potential conduits, the ways that this could become polluted in different scenarios, and then what you do about it.
For many folks in the coal fields today, in 2015, crumbling, sometimes abandoned coal industry water systems, mountain springs, streams, and store-bought bottled water. These are the options. And they can't live without water. We'll be right back with a closer look at the health risks of crumbling systems. I'm Jessica Lilly, and you're Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
I'm Jessica Lilly. Today on Inside Appalachia, we're talking about water in the coal fields of southern West Virginia. We heard from folks who live on water systems with frequent outages and advisories, and folks who use mountain springs or even contaminated wells as a source. So what are the health effects of long-term exposure to contaminated water sources? Glynis Board of West Virginia Public Broadcasting talked to experts to explore the health impacts of industrial contamination as well as naturally occurring pollutants.
If you look at particularly the southern counties of West Virginia, that's some of the largest health disparities of any place in the United States.
That's public health expert Dr. Michael McCauley, who is also the interim chair of the School of Public Health at West Virginia University. He goes on to compare health disparities and life expectancy in southern West Virginia to what you would expect to find in developing countries. And he's not exaggerating or generalizing. Recent studies show folks in McDowell County, for example, have the shortest life expectancies in the country. It's the sixth poorest county in the U.S.
In the United States, for example, the life expectancy is increasing over time. Mm-hmm. In southern West Virginia, life expectancy is actually decreasing over the past few years.
On average, women in this country live to be 81, men 76. In McDowell, however, the average woman lives to be 74, and men 66. The question ever is, why? McCauley says all roads lead back to socioeconomic status and lack of economic opportunity.
This is Inside Appalachia. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue to hear what Board uncovered about health issues associated with wastewater. Your Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. This week, we're talking about water, the most fundamental need in life, and the challenges to get it in the coal fields. We pick it back up with reporter Glynis Board.
Science these days is full of research that studies how cycles of poverty and stress and feeling like you have no choices in life leads consistently to poor health and shorter lifespans. Pinpointing what exactly makes someone ill, though, is almost impossible, McCauley says, because life is so complicated. But he says long-term exposure to compromised water is bound to leave a mark.
That's going to cause infectious disease. It's going to cause gastrointestinal problems. And that can lead to all sorts of other things.
an aquatic biologist from Wheeling Jesuit University found himself invested in water quality issues in southern West Virginia when he began looking into ecological impacts of mountaintop removal over a decade ago. Dr. Ben Stout began looking specifically at stream impairment in areas where dirt and land from the tops of ridges were pushed into valleys during surface mining operations.
Well, I mean, it was pretty obvious to me at the time that below valley fills, water quality was really tainted. And then it became a question of, is it getting into the human water supply? And I started sampling people's houses. I've sampled a lot of homes in southern West Virginia. And, you know, some people's water is really good and other people's water is really appalling.
Stout has tested for and found water spiked with a variety of heavy metals and other contaminants.
Before it's disturbed, it's as good a water as you're going to find anywhere on the planet. But after that, it becomes tainted with heavy metals and sometimes bacteria and so forth, and becomes unusable, except that these folks don't have any recourse. They pretty much have to use their water.
It's been widely reported that industrial activity has contaminated community water supplies throughout the state. But aside from industrial activity, Stout points out that naturally occurring minerals and metals like manganese can themselves be a cause of serious concern, contaminants that leach naturally from the geology of the region. The effects of manganese specifically hasn't been investigated thoroughly, but a 2010 drinking water study found that exposure to manganese at levels common in groundwater is associated with intellectual impairment in children. And Stout explains it's not easy to get dissolved metals out of water.
Well, bacteria, you know, that's where you get a boil order, you know. You can boil the water and kill the bacteria and safely consume it. But heavy metals don't turn into anything else when you boil them. They stay, you know, mercury stays mercury and aluminum stays aluminum. And if it's in their water and they're exposed to it, either via drinking, via the shower, or just, you know, in a variety of exposure pathways, they then become ill eventually over a period of time.
For all the concern about water compromised by industrial and natural sources and the cancer, decay, infection, and disease that can come with that contamination, the director of the West Virginia Water Research Institute, Paul Zimkevich, says hands down and by a long shot, the biggest threat in water supplies in southern West Virginia and many other areas in the state is raw sewage.
Anything pales in comparison. Any contaminant you can think of pales in comparison to raw, untreated sewage.
We're talking about bacteria, parasites, viruses that can cause short-term problems like diarrhea, eye infections, respiratory disease, and long-term problems like cancer, dementia, and diabetes. And there are growing concerns about potential illnesses or effects from exposure to pharmaceuticals and synthetic hormones introduced through sewage. Maggie Nevi is the project coordinator for the Waste Water Treatment Coalition in McDowell County. The coalition's main objective is to end the practice of straight piping.
Right now, 67% of the county has no form of wastewater treatment whatsoever, and they do what's called straight piping, which is exactly what it sounds like. You take a PVC pipe, you run every drain from your sink, your shower, your tub, your washing machine, and your toilet, and it all goes straight into the creek.
The idea behind her wastewater treatment coalition is to improve the health and well-being of the people who live in McDowell County, of course, but also for the people who want to visit the area. She explains how the county has been benefiting from state investments, like with the Hatfield and McCoy Trail system, for example. But Nevi says right now, ATV enthusiasts that visit should probably be concerned.
They're pretty much could be riding through raw sewage depending on the area that they're in.
Nevi says she worries about eye, ear, nose, and throat infections, especially for ATV riders who splash through creeks without helmets or goggles. Nevi says her coalition is taking steps to mitigate problems in some areas of concern. In the small community of Ashland, for example, they established a wetland which absorbs and cleans up a lot of crap.
The DEP's acceptable rate for fecal chloroform per milliliter is like 200 parts per milliliter. And in our swabs that we took of Ashland before we put the system in, it was 200,000.
Back at the West Virginia Water Research Institute, Director Paul Zimkevich says 67% of homes in McDowell County not having sewage treatment is a public health crisis. He explains that many of the pathogens you might encounter can be killed off by boiling water, but...
You don't boil water to take a shower. When the kids play in the little plastic pull-out back, are you boiling all that water too? You know, people drink this stuff, they get in contact with it. You don't boil the water before you wash your face. This stuff gets onto your person, and that's bad stuff.
In fact, whenever Zimkevich or any researchers from his team study water in the area, he requires inoculations for hepatitis B and C. And water studies are underway. West Virginia University's School of Public Health is currently studying samples from throughout southern West Virginia in an effort to grasp a finer understanding of chronic and acute problems the community faces with water supply issues. But let me make one point perfectly clear. These problems might exist in southern West Virginia to a larger degree, but raw sewage, naturally occurring manganese, and industrial impairment are problems that exist all through the state and region. Public health expert from WVU, Michael McCauley, says it falls on not only citizens within southern counties to be educated about risks and searching and moving toward solutions, but all citizens throughout the state and beyond. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
When the Elk River chemical spill happened in West Virginia's capital city, I heard from some folks in my home county. "We haven't been able to use our water for months," they told me. I heard reports and outcry from people that couldn't drink the tap water and thought, "Really? Some people actually drink water straight from their tap?" Growing up in the coal fields on the side of a mountain, I can remember water outages. We had a pipe plumbed into the hillside with an industrial white plastic bucket carefully placed to catch the water. When we ran out, we'd go to get the water to use for flushing toilets. And if it was out for too long, we'd boil it. That system has been replaced. So let's just make it happen for other folks, right? Let's just get it done. Well, going the traditional way, bringing municipal water systems to communities, isn't so easy. As the executive director of the West Virginia Regional Development and Planning Council, Shane Whitehair is familiar with dated water systems and folks hauling water. The website says the council is part of a statewide network of cooperating organizations that provides a strategic array of services to support community and economic development, planning, and intergovernmental cooperation.
Now all the easy areas have been served. Now you're getting to areas that are very rural, where the customer base is just so spread out that it's very costly to serve those areas.
So, what does it take to build a water utility in West Virginia? Well, apparently it's complicated and depends on the scenario. But here's a breakdown. Let's say a community would like to get hooked up to a neighboring water system. The community would file a formal petition to the closest utility, which would fill out an application, which I'm told isn't as simple as it sounds. If they're requesting funding from the state, the utility has to go through the Infrastructure and Jobs Development Council.
And that council is set up and made up of all the other funding sources and state agencies to provide some guidance on whether the project's technically and also financially feasible.
You have to do a survey of the community to see if there's a high enough percentage of people want it. Now, if there's a sanitary sewer that goes by your house, you have to hook up to it. If there's a water system that goes by your house, you don't have to take it.
That's Wyoming County Clerk Mike Goode. He explains part of the process involves surveys to see if the community wants access to public water. Goode has worked on several water projects in the region during his 30-year tenure as an elected official. He explains how surveys can complicate the situation, as they did in Hanover.
Now, follow me on this. City Gilbert has a water treatment plant. They sell water to the Mingo County Public Service District, which is in Justice, which comes up to the county line. In order to put a water system in Hanover, we have to buy water. And, I mean, it's everybody's fairly agreeable to this. You've got to have an agreement with the Mingo County Public Service District to buy water off of them, who in turn buys it off of the City of Gilbert. You know, I mean, you got three governmental entities there, and you got to have all kinds of user agreements and interoperability, intergovernmental agreements. And, I mean, it's just been a nightmare.
Then there's Coal Mountain.
It's kind of a catch-22 situation. It's too far removed, almost, to run a water line from another existing system. There's not anything anywhere close. It's almost too small to build a water treatment plant. They do qualify for some abandoned mine lands money, not enough to do what needs to be done. And, you know, I would really, if there's anything I'd like to see finished in Wyoming County, it's that water system.
Goode says the project hit roadblocks like a lack of funding, which in turn meant they had to resurvey the population. More roadblocks, another survey. Now the people are at the point where they're just not willing to fill out any more surveys. Once again, it's a unique situation.
To build a water treatment plant, it's going to cost you $1 million to build a plant. Then you got to put the lines in. And, I mean, no matter what you do, it's a lot of money. No matter how small it is, you've got a certain amount of work that has to be done.
That brings us to the next and biggest challenge, money. Several communities in the coal fields have benefited from abandoned mine land money. It's federal funds provided by a tax on coal companies. The money is used to repair damages done by coal companies prior to 1977, when Congress enacted the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act. But there's not enough money to fix even the high-priority health and safety-related sites, which are things like unsealed mines or unstable high walls, let alone several new water systems. It boils down to money across the state. Again, Shane Whitehair.
The demand for funding far exceeds what is available to fund these projects.
Whitehair points out that one of the most likely funding sources for these kind of projects, the Small Cities Block Grants, gets about $13 million for new projects. He says the requested funds for water and sewer alone is usually between $60 to $80 million.
By just looking at that statistic alone kind of paints a picture as to the need for the entire state as to, you know, your basic water and sewer services, whether you're making improvements to systems or extending services to rural areas of the state.
So getting water to rural places through these conventional means is just expensive, and sometimes the Public Service Commission says the residents can't afford to pay the inevitable utility bill. But it's not impossible. Goode says the most effective ingredient is the community drive. Like in Ravencliff.
Maybe 75 families, and I thought there is no way in this world that's ever going to happen. Well, they had a lot of movers and shakers up there, and that's what it takes to get it done in any community, whether the county commission wants it, whether I want it, whether the governor wants it. If somebody in the community is not spearheading it and staying on everybody's case, it doesn't get done. Well, Ravencliff had an abundance of those people. And a system, I mean, it stretched over a third of the county. And it was because a few people had a vision to get that done. I mean, that is amazing.
Goode's retiring after this term. After 30 years, after walking miles of red tape and navigating bureaucratic mazes, he says water is fundamental. And working to provide his community with cleaner, reliable water has been the most rewarding aspect of his work.
I hate getting up in the mornings and turning my tap on and not have water. You know, I mean, that's...
And that's happened to you?
Yeah, it has over the years. I am now on a city water. Used to be on a well. I'm now on city water. And I was one of the last people to get it on the Ravencliff system. So, but Yeah, I just, you know, I think everybody deserves it. They deserve to not have to worry if they want to drink water, if they want to brush their teeth, if they want to take a bath, if they want to wash their white clothes. They shouldn't have to worry about what it's going to look like.
He'd like to see the process simplified and perhaps a central entity that handles critical water infrastructure.
Them pesky men said they said, said it was the hand of God. But Reverend Crumb said no one, said no one saw God drive that first coal truck. Oh, Governor Moore, tell us what's in store for our poor and broken town. No retribution, there's no solution when the mountain is falling down. Hell is high water when there's no
One community in West Virginia decided to do something about acid mine drainage in the local creek. A group of volunteers called the Moores Creek Watershed has been making some impressive success raising trout in a once heavily polluted creek, and they've done it with a system that they invented, all on their own.
Deep in the woods above Moores Creek, near the town of Montgomery, West Virginia, Mike King stood ankle-deep in a pond full of bright orange muck. This muck wasn't natural, but Mike was happy to see it.
And this is what we're catching. This is iron, and that's how fast we're dropping it in this pond right here. Before, it would have to gradually seep all the way through here, and it would go all the way down to the bottom, but we're catching it here.
Mike was working on a homemade method of catching acid mine drainage, or AMD for short, before it could enter Moores Creek, the stream which names Mike's community and flows past his house. AMD is highly acidic water, contaminated with large amounts of trace metals, including iron and aluminum. AMD comes out of openings to particular kinds of coal mines, and as this water leaves the mine and hits the open atmosphere, it starts to lose that high acidity, causing the trace metals to gradually drop out along the length of a stream, turning the water and the stream bed bright orange, just like this pond.
The orange you see is the iron falling out. If you look at that orange, it's about this thick, and it just smothers everything. Nasty, huh?
If left unchecked, enough acid mine drainage can choke out much of the life in a stream. And as local resident Eddie Gray told me, this was the case in Moores Creek for decades, the fault of several openings to old abandoned mine works, constantly discharging polluted water into the creek. Streams polluted with AMD are familiar sights to many in coal mining regions. But starting around 2001, Eddie, Mike, and others in their community decided to take their Orange Creek into their own hands.
You know, Mike and I both grew up here. And when we were kids at a very young age, they were, crayfish and other things in the stream. You know, as a kid, we played in creek and caught bait for fishing in the river and things like that. And then shortly after that, when effects of the AMD started to play havoc on the stream, then that aquatic life ceased to exist. So now, being a little older and having kids of our own, my grandkids of his own, so, you know, we wanted to make an effort to try to restore that to the way it was when we were kids.
That's kind of where it started. Started over there at that table.
Wanda King, Mike's wife, was involved in the effort to clean Morris Creek from the beginning.
My kids grew up, the water was orange, and they didn't know it wasn't supposed to be. You know, that's a problem. The more we got into it, the more we saw the things that needed done and needed addressed, and that's how it expanded.
Meeting around Mike and Wanda's kitchen table, a group of community members formed an organization called the Morris Creek Watershed Association. And through it, they started applying for grants from agencies and programs and began organizing volunteer help from the community. They learned there is no one definitive way to deal with AMD, but instead of declaring the problem unsolvable, they embraced the challenge of figuring out how to clean their creek.
My background is in electricity and troubleshooting, and I apply those same theories to everything. I can tell you a lot of things that isn't before I can tell you exactly what it is.
In the spirit of troubleshooting, they tried a method known as a passive treatment system, a series of terraced catching ponds built near where the AMD flows out of the old mines. These ponds were lined with limestone, which reacts with the metals in the water and causes them to fall out more quickly. After a few years, the ponds worked so well in catching the AMD, the limestone became totally covered with iron and ceased being effective, so they changed their design. They sealed off the mine opening and piped the contaminated water directly into a small tank filled with limestone before the water hit the catching ponds. The AMD still dropped out in the ponds, but this new method kept the limestone from getting covered in muck.
There's limestone in this tank, and we just using the force of the water coming off the mountain, it's mixing with the limestone down in the tank. You're giving a shock to the water, and it's kind of like the same process of marinating a steak. That you actually marinate that limestone with the water for a little bit, and you actually get that boost in pH and dropping of metals in a shorter distance. It's someplace between MacGyver and Red Green. So, but it gives you a project to work on. And like I say, you can see it's working. As we stand here, it's working.
So even though their treatment systems have required constant refinement to stay effective, Mike told me that keeping the AMD out of the stream has had a transformative effect on its health.
We have 9 species of fish. We have 3 species of trout. We're the only stream in southern West Virginia that can sustain browns, rainbows, and brook trout in the length of the creek. And considering that when we started in 2001, nothing lived in the creek. The AMD was probably 3 to 4 inches thick in this area. It was just orange muck stuck to the bottom of the creek. We've saved our creek just by being innovative.
While Mike feels their group is making a local impact, he thinks that to really clean up Central Appalachia's waterways on a regional level, local watershed protection groups like theirs could stand to get more support, state, federal, and otherwise. For example, Mike told me it wasn't too hard to obtain grant money to build AMD treatment systems, but he said it's incredibly difficult to find funds to actually maintain them, which is necessary to keep them working.
I think watersheds should be funded more because they're very effective for the most part. Watersheds know what's going on. They know what the problems are. Yeah. I'd like to actually like to see a recon team put together with folks that are dedicated to this kind of work, and you go in and help communities deal with those problems.
There are federal rules requiring coal companies to keep these sorts of AMD problems from happening, but those rules can be subject to wide interpretation, and there are abandoned mines throughout Appalachia and other coal regions still causing AMD, as well as many other environmental problems. Mike is not against coal mining, but he thinks that coal operators will have no real incentive to keep this kind of pollution from happening until company CEOs themselves are held personally responsible.
You know, a lot of people give the EPA flack, say they're trying to ruin coal. Well, the EPA is saying, how are you effectively going to mine the coal and not have this happen again? That's exactly what they're saying. Now, I know the coal companies will say,
Well, we can't do that cost effectively. Well, if you're giving your CEO $26 million bonuses, you could use a little of that money to come back over here and fix some of these AMD problems. I think we can effectively mine coal. I think we can effectively burn coal. I think we can do a whole host of things when it comes to gas exploration. But we have to have companies, their CEOs, and their board of directors held personally liable when they choose not to follow safety and environmental practices. And that's when we'll make a change.
The AMD treatment system Mike showed me is just one of dozens of projects going on at any one point in time at the Morris Creek Watershed Association. They've done trout release projects with local schools. They've tried out small-scale hydropower on the creek. And they've even experimented with hybrid chestnut trees, among other projects. To share all of this work, the group has regularly hosted visitors, students, and volunteers from around the country and the world. Moving forward, they hope to build an environmental education center to help spread their story even further and to give even more people reason to visit their small West Virginia town, with the ultimate hope of instilling pride in the community, bringing economic life to the area, and improving the quality of life for everyone along the creek.
I'm one of these folks that I just like to get involved and do something. And if we fail, what have we lost? Let's go look at more stuff.
Reporting for WMMT, I'm Parker Hobson.
The water in Moores Creek isn't being used for human consumption. They're not drinking it. At least, not yet. Still, it's remarkable that a group of volunteers has been able to turn a watershed in southern West Virginia, once choked with pollution, into a creek bursting with aquatic life once again. Music in today's show was provided by Alan Cathead Johnston and Stacy Grubb in South 52, Andy Agnew Jr., Jake Schweppes, and Glennis Board. Our producer is Roxy Todd. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at @InAppalachia or at @WVJessicaYLilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.